Good morning.
Does our new platform increase your visibility back there? Hi, Karen. Good. That's the spirit behind this, to be a little more easily seen and heard. As a Sunday speaker, we have large crowds, relatively speaking, on Sundays, and so making the person sitting here more easily seen and heard becomes important. So, but this is weird, you guys. Just enough to make me very uncomfortable. Yeah, I usually do that just at home alone. So you've got a program that has on it a small verse. It's part of a practice instruction that was written by the Zen teacher Hongzhi in, I want to say, the 13th century, and I think I'm close. I might be off by 100 years. Maybe he's 12th century in China. And I'm a great fan of his. I really, really love his voice. To my awareness, very few translations have been done of his work. And the book that came into my life about probably 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, was translated by a Western Zen teacher some of you may have heard of, Taigen Layton. He's the head of the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate Temple in Chicago now. But he's a great translator, and he's translated a huge number of Dogen's works as well as some Chinese material as well. And Hongzhi's material that he translated into a book that he called Cultivating the Empty Field, that is primarily practice instructions, and then also has some poetry of Hongzhi's at the back. And it's a volume I highly recommend. I highly recommend Cultivating the Empty Field. And the voice of the work is very much like the piece that you're looking at today. And I'm aware that this style of writing has a lot of appeal and energy for some folks, and for some folks not so much. It's not very linear. It's not very practical. It's not very, and the language isn't every day. It's much closer to prose poetry than it is to first do this, then do this, then do this. It's very, very different from that type of energy. And it's part of why I like it, because what it does for me, and this is what I'm going to encourage we do together, is that we recite this piece together, and that while you're reciting it, you know, listen to the voices of your community this morning. Just listen to how all of our voices blend together, and notice how it makes you feel. For me, the instruction in this piece is about how it makes me feel. It's less about the specificity of language. It's less about the words that Taigen would have chosen to try to translate this. It is closer to poetry, and poetry is much more about how it helps us to see the world in a different way and perhaps feel about the world in a different way. Right? It appeals to a different way of knowing. And a lot of Zen literature, of course, does this, but I just find Hongzhi's voice especially evocative for me. So if you'd be kind enough to indulge me, let's just read it together. We'll just read it. We'll just recite it the way we would normally, and see how it sounds, and see how it makes you feel. So he calls this, and this would be Taigen's words, he calls this short passage The Cloud's Fascination and the Moon's Cherishing. A person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountain appears. The moon sets and the water is cool. Each bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. Every dust is whole without reaching me. The 10,000 changes are stilled without shaking me. If you can sit here with stability, then you can freely step across and engage the world with energy, always arriving everywhere without being confused, gentle without hesitation. The perfected person knows where to go. So I'm just going to talk about this today. That'll be my talk. And this has a, it has kind of a koanic quality to it to me. Meaning koan-like, meaning that how it shows up in my consciousness may well be different than how it shows up in yours. And again, kind of like poetry, every interpretation is every interpretation. And they're all equally lovely, equally valid. So it's one of my favorite things to do is to structure a talk around going through a piece like this and just kind of unpacking it line by line. I really like it. And the reason I like it, I think, is because when I read something like this, it moves me. I go, oh, I really like this. And I go, I wonder why. Because I don't actually know. And the way that I help myself to understand what's moving in me is to write a talk about it. You know how they say, if you want to learn something, teach it? So I'm trying to learn about the cloud's fascination and the moon's cherishing. So I'm just going to share with you my impressions, but I'll remind you that they're just mine. The Dharma here is in your chest. It's how you feel when you read this. That's the only Dharma. Actually, that's the Dharma. So he starts by saying, a person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. And our first interpretation of that is the most obvious is a person of the way, the person of Buddhism, a person of the path, is a home leaver. Because that would have been the tradition. You leave home, you do not dwell anywhere. That's part of the requirements for ordination. You're a nun, you're a monk, you leave home, you don't dwell anywhere. You are a renunciate, you're a mendicant, you're a, in Japanese, unsui, U-N-S-U-I, cloud person. When you take the vows of a monk or a nun, you become a cloud person. It just means whoosh, you're changing constantly. You don't have a home. So that's kind of the party line. But you sort of get the feeling that's underneath this, right? A person of the way is just you already, whether you've been to Zen Center for 50 years or you've never been here before, or you self-define as Buddhist or you self-define as Christian or not at all or whatever. We can't dwell anywhere. Hard as we try. Am I right? Hard as we try, our experience is defined by impermanence. We don't dwell. We don't stay anywhere. And it's true. I mean, in the end, we are nomads on this earth. And so maybe to make that less abstract, just sort of just run through your memory and think of all the places that you have lived. You know, the actual homes, apartments, dorm rooms, yurts, all the addresses you have, all the spaces you've walked through in your life, all the air you've breathed, all the objects you've looked at, the people you've touched, the things you've touched. You know, all those places that you have included into your life. The people, the objects, the sensations, the times you felt pain and pleasure and joy and sorrow. The landscape of our lives is constant, constant, constant change. We don't dwell. We do not abide. There is no abiding. We can't stay. So we are change. We're part of change. We're inside of change. That is the nature of reality. And that is actually his starting place. With this little practice instruction, his starting place is flow, flow, flow. A person of the way does not abide anywhere. And yeah, sure, it starts off being about Buddhists. This would have been given to a group of monks who would have understood it in that way. But you can feel the landscape of his heart here is way, way, way beyond that. I mean, everything is change. Nothing abides. So he plays a lot in the course of this piece with the interplay between change and permanence, between emptiness and form. And he'll juxtapose things that are very obviously changing, clouds, and things that appear to be permanent, mountain. And we play with that tension. But his starting point, his understanding is even the mountain is going, gone. Right? Everything is going, gone. So I actually really like that feeling. There are times when the teaching of impermanence, and of course in Buddhism we're talking about impermanence all the time, to have a deep experience of impermanence, to truly understand impermanence, is so important to the Buddhist path because it ventilates our suffering. It just helps ventilate our suffering. Oh, this is such a difficult moment. I'm in so much pain now. It's also flowing constantly, and it's moving, despite my impression that it feels so heavy and it's immovable, and I imagine it being permanent, and I imagine I've always felt this heavy way, and I imagine it will never leave. I know that that's not true. And if I'm wise enough to look at my experience for even a few seconds, I see, well, actually, no storm has ever shown up that didn't pass. I've never had a feeling that stayed, ever. I've never had a feeling that stayed. Some stay longer, kinda. And one of the neat things about meditation practice, mindfulness practice, is when we're encouraged, as we are, to get really, really close to our emotions, even that feeling, oh, I was mad for 4 hours. No, you weren't. Get really close to it. It was changing the whole time. I can put it maybe broadly into the category of being cranky for 4 hours, but within those 4 hours, it was higher, lower, hotter, cooler, sharper, duller. There was joy mixed in there. There was discontent of a different flavor mixed in. Maybe there was some sadness in there. Maybe there was something else, right? The invitation is always to touch our experience so intimately that we see it's constantly changing. That even the things we think are abiding are actually move. It's a wonderful place to start. It gives me a feeling of spaciousness, and I think that helps. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. Isn't that nice? Of course, all of his imagery here is from the natural world. Very, very common in Zen literature, especially early Zen literature, because it was so heavily influenced by the Taoist tradition, and all of their metaphors came from the natural world. So there's a lot of Taoist energy in this piece. The white clouds fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. When I read that, I'm like, oh yeah, I know that feeling. I feel like a white cloud because that thing in my life that appears to be immovable is fascinating to me. I think one of the reasons we love going to mountains, actually, is because we just imagine that it's been there for 100,000 years and will be there for 100,000 more. There's something about that. I don't know, it's evocative. It feels timeless. Wow, my little life is just coming and going so quickly, but this mountain has been here and been here and been here. There's something, don't you think? I'm just like, wow, there's a feeling there. We are fascinated with the Green Mountain's foundation. We're moved by it. The presence of it feels vast, and we kind of marvel in our heads maybe or in our hearts at the size of it, at the stability of it, at what we perceive to be its sort of infinite presence, its infinite patience. Some of you have probably done that mountain meditation, you know, where you close your eyes and it's essentially a guided visualization. You imagine yourself as a mountain. Tim has done it. Actually sitting here, he's guided people through a short version of it where you imagine yourself as a mountain, which, you know, when you take the cross-legged posture is easy to do. It has a big, wide, stable base and a peak, you know, and you close your eyes and you imagine, you know, the weather changing and the seasons changing and the animals coming and going and green growing things and the no green growing things and the rivers and the boulders and the whole thing, and you're just staying and you're staying and you're staying in the midst of all the change. You are the stable presence. It's a grounding feeling. It feels really good. So that's a little bit like our Zazen practice. That's why that's a popular meditation. When we take up the practice of meditation in this tradition, it takes us a while, most of us anyway, to develop the physical stability of the posture, to actually be able to keep our seat physically, to make peace with sitting still in our bones and in our muscles. We're not used to doing that. And so it takes us a while to kind of make our peace with that. And after we do that, we start noticing the landscape of the mind and the emotions changing and changing. You know, emotions arising and shifting and passing, and thoughts arising and shifting and passing. And as we are observing this constant flow of experience, you know, all these sensations, shifting and leaving in sounds and emotions and thoughts, we start to identify ourselves with the stable observer more so than we're normally identified with the thing that is always changing. So I think for the most part, especially if we're new to meditation practice, most of us identify ourselves with our thoughts and with our emotions. I'm really angry and I'm thinking about blank, and that's just what I am. And I forget that I have not always felt that way and I have not always thought that. And I'm so identified with what we call the contents of consciousness that I forget about this huge panoramic awareness that holds all of them with stability. So to go back to his lovely sky metaphor, we are much more identified in normal life with the quality of the clouds, the shape of the clouds, than we are with the stability of that which observes them, the sky that holds them or the mountain that lets them pass by. And after we've sat for a while, and you know, this doesn't take too long. It doesn't take too long. I think if people are new to meditation, they sit every day for even a month, they start to notice a subtle shift. They start to notice that it's a little bit easier for them to click into the observer and to be less caught, perhaps, a little less arrested by the content of their experience. They become a little bit more identified with the calm observer. I think that's true. It's different for everybody, but I think that's true. That shift is really important for us. To be the screen and not the movie, I think is another way of putting that, to start thinking of ourselves as the screen. So he goes on, Huangzi goes on to talk about the bright moon, and the moon in Zen literature is oftentimes equated with enlightenment. That's our big symbol in the Zen tradition for enlightenment. We choose the moon. The bright moon. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. I really love Tigan's translation here. I don't know what the original Chinese would be, but the term cherish is a really, I really love the feeling that word gives me. I like that more than appreciate or value. I love cherish. That feels warmer to me. It feels like love to me, to be cherished. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. So, you know, here again we have a symbol of the eternal, the moon, and a symbol of the transient, that dynamic flowing water. And to be able to see the eternal, to be able to see emptiness in the midst of the flow, in the midst of the transient, in the midst of the changing landscape of our lives, that's one of the invitations of Zen practice. To see enlightenment in everyday mind, to see the eternal in the play of time. You know, in our Heart Sutra, we use terms like form and emptiness. Eternity would be equated with emptiness, and the changing field with form. I love the idea. I mean, again, Hongzhi is using an emotion word. He's not even just saying, oh, we can see eternity in the forms of time. He's saying eternity appreciates being reflected in the forms of time. That's why I think I like this. I think that's why it feels more like poetry to me, because he's not just giving you, it's a sort of didactic about bum, bum, emptiness form. He's infusing this whole thing with a sense of emotion, that when the moon sees its reflection in the mountain stream, it kind of goes, ah, look how it's carrying me along, the dancing play of light in the water. Wow. I think we're making the assumption the moon has incredibly good vision and can sort of see, you know. Wow, look, there it is. And don't we see that? I mean, I love that. That teaching shows up all the time in Zen. What is Buddha? Everyday mind. What is Buddha? The oak tree. What is Buddha? Your gurgling stomach right now. Quit thinking it's later or extra or apart, or even that it's going to show up looking or feeling a certain way, something loftier. It's just this, it's just this, it's just this. The moon reflected in the stream. The eternal reflected in the forms of time. We play with these opposites. We play with the tension between these opposites so that someday we understand that there's no separation, right? Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form, right? That the moon is the stream is the moon. And I like the term appreciate because, and cherish because I like the term cherish because it moves me into a warmer emotional field, and warmer emotional fields help me to understand non-separate. I don't know why that is. If I try to think of non-separation rationally, I come up against, I just have a harder time. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll take your word for it. I can't intellectually grasp that, and I don't have another way of knowing up here in my noodle, in my head. But I do have other ways of knowing as a living being, right? I have senses, and I have emotions, and I have intuitions, and I've got guts, and I've got a heart. Wow, there's a lot of different ways of knowing, right? And Buddhism is always encouraging us to use all of them. Start with your body, check in with your bones. This is your muscles. This is your way of knowing about existence. You're knowing about, right? This is your way of knowing. It isn't just this little thing. We're knowing. We know thirst in a non-conceptual way. We know hunger in a non-conceptual way. We know heat and cool in a non-conceptual way. We know love in a non-conceptual way. Intuition is non-conceptual, right? These are just ways of knowing. And so it's a way of understanding non-separateness. The core teaching, non-separateness. Over and over we hear about this, non-separate, non-separate. So much of your suffering comes from this idea you have, this insistence you have that you're separate, that things are separate. And there's ways of understanding non-separate that aren't necessarily conceptual, that are just... And so the idea of... You know, Joseph Campbell says it this way. He says, eternity is in love with the forms of time. Isn't that a great sentence? Eternity is in love with the forms of time. It loves just showing up and vanishing, showing up and vanishing, showing up and vanishing. You know? The moon is eternal. It would cherish being carried along in the mountain stream. Oh, look, it's my light is... There I am, dancing in the stream, and then whoosh, the stream is gone. It's a game, right? It's a game. It's why we have flowers, right, on our altar. Because whoosh, when you come back next Sunday, those will be in the compost bin, right, in the alley. And the week after that, they'll be at the landfill or off wherever, whatever they do with compost, I don't know. They're going, gone. So we look at them, and that gets to be our clouds, and we get to be the mountain. We imagine ourselves as being more permanent than them. Sure, okay, that's conventionally true. Whoosh, going, gone. Wow. It creates a feeling in us. It creates a feeling of appreciation. I hope it does. And of course, what he's hoping for, I mean, he's again talking to a bunch of monks who are used to thinking of, you know, moon as enlightenment and understanding that symbol. And of course, these are a bunch of monks, so they're there chasing after enlightenment, and they're facing the wall in their black robes, and this is, you know, it's very rigorous. Zen is rigorous. It's rigorous. We have to go past our ego boundaries. We have to go, there's always an ordeal component. We have to go past our normal da-da-da to get to this. And yet, the cherishing is such an important word because there's this sense of there's an invitation there. You understand you're vanishing, right? You understand you're vanishing, right? Can you appreciate that? Can you fall in love with it? Can you actually cherish it? I mean, it's pretty easy to, oh, I cherish the flowers, and I know in the back of my head they'll be gone in a week. Oh, it makes it poignant. My life is the same way. My life is sitting on the altar of the world. It's vanishing. It will be in the compost pile in a very short amount of time. In a very short amount of time, poof, I'll be under the roses instead of on top of them. Right? Like we all will. Can I cherish that? Oh, right? Wow. Then all of a sudden the bouquet is in the center of my chest and not someplace else. And then I see it in you and in you and in you, and it isn't. Wow, I'm right back to non-separateness again. I understand now, I begin to understand that this eternity and the forms of time and the moon and the water, this is just a dance. It's just a dance, right? The universe playing hide and seek with us. All the time, don't you think? It's just all the time. We're playing hide and seek with it. It's playing hide and seek with us. It's a game. I'm not here. I'm here. I'm not here. I'm here. You know, if you've done that with a 18-month-old or whatever, like, that doesn't get old for them. Ever. You know? So it makes me just a little bit sad that at some point that does get old to us. Because we develop something called object permanence. Right? That's a lie. Right? It's a lie. There is no object permanence. I like to think if I sit zazen long enough, peekaboo will go right back to being fascinating and amazing to me. Because I will so fully understand, oh my God, there is no object permanence. This whole thing is a dance, that I'll go right back to being, oh, you're gone. Oh, there you are again. Oh, this is fantastic. And I'll giggle every time. That's my hope. So, he says, the clouds part and the mountain appears. The clouds part and the mountain appears. So this is our experience. This is all of our experience. After a while, the clouds part. They always do. They always come back, and they always part. So after a time sitting on these zafus, sitting in these chairs, the clouds will part for you. They always do. These can be small cloud partings, like my busy mind got calmer and I saw something that was more permanent. Just, oh, it's okay to just be here. That's pretty good. In fact, that's really good. Sometimes the cloud parting is something bigger. The illusion, the veil of separateness parts. We see through that. We understand that as a fiction. Maybe there's a big experience around that. Maybe there's an emotional release. Maybe there's a breakthrough. A mental breakthrough. Wow. Cool. That's fine. That's fine. But knowing that this is part of the interplay and being a willing participant in the interplay between the mountain and the clouds is what Soto Zen is about. We don't need to be told to know that there isn't a storm that lasts forever. We already know, all of us, that the clouds always part. We know that. And sitting zazen, regardless of the nature of our experience on that cushion, will show us over time, if we are patient, if we are kind, it will show us these things all by itself. So as you guys know, as most of you know, in the Soto tradition, we do not put a lot of emphasis on the biggie, the big breakthrough, the big experience, the big cloud parting. Yeah, cool. If it happens, great. Particularly nice day. But it's just weather. It's just weather. The mountains, the clouds are the clouds. Them looking white and puffy and blue is lovely. That's one of their moods. But that doesn't make them better clouds. And the mountain couldn't care less. Couldn't care less. So it's a very patient, long, long path. And the neat thing about the way he puts this is we begin to see the stable backdrop, right? The way he's using these metaphors, the way I see him using these metaphors is after the clouds part, I can see the stability underneath them. Oh, when I start to realize the chatter stops and there's something stable there. Oh, that's lovely for me to know that. I get a sense of that. Oh, there's a dimension of my consciousness that's always just still and reflective, that just sees, that just is, that just knows outside of the changing, right? Dogen, for this, uses the metaphor of swimming on the surface of the ocean and walking on the bottom at the same time. You swim on the surface and you walk on the bottom. You do abide in the world that is changing constantly, waves, up, down, big, small, dramatic weather, boring weather, relationships, Texas, life, right? The changing phenomena, hearing things and having them vanish. We swim on the surface, and at the same time, we walk on the bottom. We are aware that the very same ocean is really, really busy at the top and dramatic, and it's totally still at the bottom. Totally still. Same ocean. Not two different oceans. Same ocean. And we need to be reminded of this all the time. Because when we start coming to Zen Center, I'm like, oh, I'm swimming in the surface, and I'm aware of it, and I hate it. I want to go to that ocean that's really, really calm all the time. And the teacher says, it's the same ocean. It's the same mind. You understand? Your same mind has both waves and stillness. It's the same thing. Right? It's the same thing. Just sit still. Just sit still for a while. You'll find this out. Just sit still. So, we sit still. We notice the clouds start to part. We see the mountain. And here's the neat thing about the metaphor. Does the clouds parting create that still mountain? No, it doesn't. It's always been there. It's always been there. And this, I hear this over and over and over when I read, and I don't do this much anymore, but when I was young in Zen practice, I read a lot of enlightenment stories because they were very compelling. They are. They are. They're very dramatic and they're hugely compelling. And story after story after story after story, she has her big breakthrough, and then, wow, what's the nature of breakthrough? Oh, it was here all along. They always say some variation on, oh my God, it was there all along. It was always there. Nothing has changed at all. My eyes are just open. I see it. It has always been there. So it really is like when the clouds part. Oh, the mountain! It's not like, ooh, they just invented a mountain just for me. No. Always been there, always been there, always been there. Your enlightenment has always been there. It can't not be there. The fact you're looking for it is evidence that, of course, it's there. It's always been there. It is just... That is the permanent abiding. And then the clouds come back. Good. That's good, too. The moon sets and the water is cool. I really like this. I like this because it's a beautiful natural image, but what if we apply the enlightenment metaphor to the moon? Enlightenment goes away, then what? The water's cool. That's fine. Even in the middle of the winter when you can't see the moon, it's still there. It's actually still there. You know, even when it's totally occluded, because it's in that phase where it's just black and you can't see it, or that time of year, or it's behind clouds. It doesn't have to show up as dominating the horizon. It doesn't have to show up as full and glowing. It doesn't have to show up as that in order to be there. The moon sets, and we think of it as gone, and the water is cool. Everything is still fine. When the great wisdom insight of Zazen is over, we see how, even a little, maybe, our senses have cooled. Maybe our heart is a little stiller. Maybe our habits of mind are slightly less compelling. That's okay. That's okay. He really embraces the mundane, Hongzhe. He really embraces when the big dramatic thing isn't happening. He really wants to insist that that's enlightenment too. So the moon always sets, because it does. It always rises and then it always sets. But the cool water is real. And even if you don't recognize it as enlightenment, even if you don't recognize it as abiding peace, you can still touch it. Right? You can still drink it. You can let it become you. Isn't that neat how when you drink a glass of water, it becomes you? I don't know. I just think that's cool. I never get sick of that. I'm drinking this glass of water as I'm giving this talk. And at the beginning of my talk, it was a glass of water that was separate from me. The convention. And by the end of the talk, there's no glass of water. But I'm one glass of water bigger. It's just become Busho now. Whoosh. Just playing games. The universe playing games. Every bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. So he was wrong because it's summer. It's not autumn, it's summertime. But you know, my guess is that this applies to summer as well. Every bit of summer. Every bit of July. What is this? The 16th? Every bit of July 16th contains vast interpenetration without bounds. Every season, every bit of our passing phenomena contains vast interpenetration without bounds. The term we hear most often when people are describing kind of Buddhism 101 is interconnectedness, which is right. It's a good word. It seems to work okay. I have a preference, it's a slight preference, but I have a preference for the term interpenetration, because even though it's kind of unnecessarily long and sort of confusing, we don't hear it outside of Zen centers very often, it's a little more accurate. Interconnectedness, it's still pretty easy for my mind to imagine that they are separate things that have a connection between them. You know, so if we hold hands, I am connected to you, but we are still, this is the thing that connects us. I'm still pretty attached to the idea that we're separate, but interpenetrate becomes really, it's harder for me to conceptualize the separation. I love interpenetrate. I love interpenetrate. Wow. It's harder for me to see inside, outside, and separate. And we use the term intimacy a lot in Zen, and in some Zen literature, intimacy, what's translated as intimacy, is used as a exact synonym for enlightenment. What is enlightenment? Just intimacy. Non-separateness. The realization of non-separateness, that's enlightenment. The realization of deep intimacy, so intimate now that the idea of two stops being quite so compelling. Interpenetration. Every bit of July 16th contains vast interpenetration without bounds. Our seeing through separation really means just integrating it. It's not that things stop being separate. It's that we understand it's one of the forms of non-separateness. That's confusing, isn't it? Yeah, but that's true. Separation is one of the forms that non-separateness takes. Like form is emptiness. A non-separate reality shows up as and appears as separate objects interacting. That's part of the game. One of the ways the moon shows up is the light reflecting in the water. That's one of the ways that reality shows up. And so separation integrated, when I say to integrate this awareness, what it's about is understanding, and I don't know that this is conceptual, I'm touching my chest again as I'm saying this, I think it's understanding there in my cells. When I understand that separateness is one of the ways that my mind likes to create the universe and that that's illusory but helpful, I think it softens the edges. I think it softens the edges of separation. Right? Useful fiction. It's a useful fiction. Jeez, it's useful. It is. It's a useful fiction. But when I start believing in separateness, that's when the grief arises. That's when the pain arises. That's when greed arises as a result of separateness. Hate arises as a result of separateness. Grief, attachment. I mean, think of a form of suffering in your life. Is it not on some level based on the fundamental assumption of separateness? Has to be. Has to be. So separation integrated, meaning I'm understanding in a much deeper way what separation actually is and what non-separation actually is, means I can begin to enjoy it. I can begin to actually enjoy it. And I understand the flowers, and I understand peekaboo. That's why peekaboo is so fun, right? It's like, we're separate, no we're not. We're separate, no we're not. Just kidding, just kidding. You died and you left. Just kidding. Right? Where do they go? Is there another? Just kidding, right? This is a game, it's a dance. It's not to say we don't experience it as painful. But understanding that it's a dance, understanding this is the part of the dance where we separate. Because, you know, dancing is a great metaphor. We come together in dancing, and we go apart in dancing. We come together in dancing, and we go apart in dancing, right? We're acting something out. As human organisms, we're acting something archetypal out. We understand that you come together, and you go apart, and you come together, and you go apart. And it's all part of one big non-separate thing called the dance. And you might prefer the closeness or you might prefer the separation within the terms of the dance, but it's just part of it, right? But the one big thing, wow. Now I have a unified mountain, unified with clouds. There's just one thing happening. It's just a game. So every dust is whole without reaching me. The 10,000 changes are stilled without shaking me. What he's doing now, and this is very this is typical for him, because these are practice instructions. So as poetry, I love the poetic image of this stuff. I think as poetry it stands on its own, but I like to remind myself these were actually intended to be practical practice instructions. Isn't that funny? This is actually his practical instruction. So when you read his poetry, you're like, oh wow, you're way off the map. It's fantastic. But he's talking now about, he's giving you a broad outline, non-separate, non-separate, non-separate. Notice the nature of consciousness being changing and being abiding and being permanent and being changed, right? But now he's going into, this is more practical. How does this show up in my everyday life? These are lofty teachings and they're wonderful, but how do they actually show up when I'm essentially in difficulty? When I'm in difficulty, the dusts of the world is how we talk about difficulty, the things of the world, the attachments of the world. The dust, sometimes called the red dust. Yeah, that's the stuff. It's the grit in your shoe. It's the tax bill. It's the spouse who's not listening to you right now. It's the car that broke down. It's the fact you've got a job to do. The fact it's da-da-da-da. It's the dusts of the world. They are whole without reaching me. The 10,000 changes are stilled without shaking me. He's talking about equanimity. Isn't that the feeling? At least that's the feeling it gives me, this feeling of equanimity. Of course those things are happening, and I am part of them. It's not that I'm separate from them. I don't achieve my contentment by separating from the things that give me suffering. That's not the Zen way. We find our contentment by finding contentment in the things. Right? It isn't when the backache goes away do I become content. It's, can you become content in the middle of backache? If you can't find serenity in the middle of traffic jam, you do not have serenity. Right? If your serenity is contingent upon there being no bills to pay, no difficulties in any relationship, no back pain, no traffic, well, then you can join the rest of the 7 billion of us who are trying constantly to rearrange all of the circumstances in our life magically so that everything shows up and I can finally feel content for 5 minutes. Will you all just give me a break? Right? And I'm like, wow, no wonder we're suffering constantly, this constant effort to, oh, how must it be different? How must it be different? How must it be different? His framing of this is radical to me. Every dust, every affliction, every thing that needs to be done, everything on your to-do list, every little rock in your shoe is whole. It's whole. Without reaching me, the 10,000 changes, the million myriad things in your life that are all the time, they are stilled without shaking me. I think all of us get a sense of what he's talking about. And we start by getting that sense, most of us anyway, on the cushion, noticing how the 10,000 dusts and the 10,000 changes and the 10,000 voices and the 10,000 afflictions start to quiet down and those patterns become calmer and we begin to let them go. On the cushion, right? We begin to notice how much of that we carry with us, how our resistance is what causes us suffering, how the suffering is the thing we want to be different, and we get better at laying that down, putting it down, setting it down, not engaging with it on the cushion, so we can experience some peace. And then we get better at doing that off the cushion. Because the goal of Zazen isn't like, oh, I've got a half an hour apiece before the timer goes off and I got to go back out there to the rat race. Right? That's how it feels at the beginning. I know, that's how it feels. That's cool. But after a while, you start realizing, oh, I'm doing a really good job of setting the stuff down in the middle of the stuff. In the middle of the traffic jam, I can set the traffic jam down. Right? I don't have to choose the suffering around this moment. I can choose to have this moment be a moment of non-suffering by just the way I'm encountering it. Right? Of course I can't escape the dust of the world. Of course I can't escape the changes, nor would I want to. Zen is an engaged, involved, practice-based thing, right? It is not an escape from the worlds. It's an engagement with the worlds. But we recognize the suffering comes from inside. So what I do there, how I deal with the suffering inside my chest, at some point it dawns on me, that's portable. Right? I mean, it's portable. It doesn't have to be on a black cushion that I find peace. The peace follows us. It follows us. It's nice to be in the middle of a crazy situation and not feel crazy. I hope you've had that experience of being right in the middle of something just really, really, really crazy and not actually feel crazy. So I don't know if that's for you a protest march or if that's being in a crowd of really, really angry people and not feeling angry. Or maybe it's for you a family gathering where everybody's really being abusive and angry and toxic and name-calling, and you're not. You're just not. You get to do that. Isn't that cool? You get to do that. You can be in the world's dust and not covered in dust. And Zen, we call that the unstained and the stained. I have an issue with that line, but anyway. Tim said he'd prefer, I prefer the word the stained and the unstained. And I was like, well, that's a lot closer to, anyway. So, I gotta wrap up here. I'm gonna skip to the last line. Actually, no, I'm not. I'm gonna mush the two last lines. If you can sit here with stability, then you can freely step across and you can engage the world with energy, always arriving everywhere, without being confused, gentle, without hesitation. The perfected person knows where to go. So the reason I want to talk about this for just a minute is because this is about engagement. All right? He gives us an overview about the interplay of form and emptiness, permanence and transiency. He talks about, very briefly, our relationship with suffering and how it shows up with the dust and the changes. And now he's talking about the relationship between sitting with stability and engaging the world with energy. All right? Zen goes to the mountaintop, but it does not stay there. It does not stay there. You go back to the marketplace. You go back to the family with the toxic relationships. You go back to the job with the coworker who drives you crazy. You go back to the bus stop. You go back to, right? That's the world that needs our peace. We have to cultivate peace because that's what the world needs. We take it back out. We engage with energy. We engage with energy. And that energy is rooted in stability. I think this is the timeliest piece of this for those of us in this room today. A lot of us don't like a lot of things. How the things are. Is it the things in my job? Is it the things in the political world? Is it the thing with race relations? Is it the thing with gender relations? Is it the thing with my family? Is it the thing with my, We're very easily reactive to things that cause us suffering. And they make us scared. They make us frightened of what we might become, what the world might become. We become driven to action. And if we look at that really, really carefully, I don't like how things I am, and I am scared, and so I'm driven to. It's very important for me to know that's what fueling my action right now is rejection, judgment, and fear. It is not stability, it is not acceptance, it is not wisdom, and it is not compassion. Do I need to act in the world with energy? Oh yes, I do. In order for me to be a content human being, I have to do that. It's also what the world is crying desperately out to me and to everybody in this room to do. Please see my pain and please respond to it. But please respond to it. Don't just react. Don't just cover. Don't yell back. Why would I need that? Nobody needs to be yelled at. Right? Of course the world needs our peace. Of course it needs peace despite its turmoil. It needs our acceptance despite its brokenness. It needs our fearlessness despite its fear. But it doesn't need my reactivity. It doesn't need my judgment. It doesn't need more. It needs genuine engagement. So now we know what this whole path has been about from the very beginning. A person of the way. When I understand impermanence, when I understand the interplay of feelings, when I understand, because I've been sitting on a cushion for long enough to know that things like anger arise and change and leave all by themselves, and things like sadness arise and change and leave all by themselves, I don't have to react to this circumstance as if the entire universe is hanging on a thread, because it's not. We're clouds and mountains, and we're perfect exactly as we are, and we need improvement, as Suzuki says. We say that a lot. We're perfect as we are, and we need improvement. And if I skip that first part, I'm in big trouble. If all I see is the needs improvement, everything is about judgment, rejection, fear. Everything. Everything I do is going to be about change you, change you, change you, change me, not enough, not enough, not good enough, broken, flawed. I'm right back again to that place that causes me so much pain. I have to understand the perfect first before I can engage with the needs improvement. I have to. So I don't know what perfect is. The last line is the perfected person. I would suggest that perfection is anything done with love. That's what my wife says. She said, I don't know what perfection is. I think it's just anything done with love. I went, I'm going to write that down. I'm going to steal it. I'm going to put it in the talk, and I'm going to credit you. Hi, Karen. That's pretty good. Because a perfected person is just all of us, and it's none of us, and it's all of us. So don't let that separate this teaching from you. Please know you're included in that circle. And finally, arrive. Just arrive. Arriving everywhere. When we're calm, when our hearts are still, we're not confused. We don't hesitate. Hong's just right, you guys. We arrive without being confused. When my heart is still, I know what to do. I just do. Toxic family, institutional racism, angry coworker, I know what to do when I have a still heart. And maybe it's just listen and cry along with somebody who's in pain. Maybe it's hold a sign lovingly. I don't know. But he's really intentional about saying gentle without hesitation. Your first impulse without hesitation is gentleness, is kindness, is engagement, is yes. It has to be. And it takes a while for this to be our reaction, our natural response. Gentleness, understanding, non-separation. We are together. Let's do this. Then we know where to go. And I think in that moment we are perfected people, right? I don't know. Sure. Why isn't that true? That sounds right. So I encourage you to keep doing this practice. This is a place a lot of this kind of teaching, wonderful people like Hongzhi, we get to hear their voices in places like this. We get to practice sitting still in places like this. We get to practice imagining that everything is okay. We get to practice starting to feel that maybe everything is okay. And then we get to start moving into action, knowing what to do in places like this. So I thank you for being here today. And I'm sorry I went on so long, we don't have time for questions. But that's okay, Hong just answered all of ours. So, Raymond, I'll turn it back to you, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.